Good afternoon. So last time we finished our discussion of the page cache, talking about how we would manage doing replacements in that cache. And we expanded from the least recently used idea to things that we could actually implement. And we went through sort of three different specific approximations, all based around the idea that we're going to track over some period of time whether a page is accessed or not, or referenced or not. Both terms mean the same thing in this case. And use that information to decide what to replace in some way, which is going to not replace things which have been used more recently. So our simplest scheme for that was second chance. We just had a big list of pages. Pages started at the top of that list as not referenced, and went to the bottom of the list eventually. And we take something off the bottom of the list, see if it was referenced, and if it was, we put it back on the top of the list as not referenced, otherwise we'd use it again. Or otherwise we'd use it as what we replace. We had a variant of this where we had a separate active and inactive list, and we only scanned things on this inactive list. So basically, by putting something on the inactive list, we were making this hypothesis that it was not going to be accessed soon, and we waited for that to be disproved by seeing an access, in which case we removed it back to the active list. And we have this sort of generalization of that, where we wanted to just scan periodically and we could collect some history information to do that. And I guess I forgot to mention on this slide, we also talked about sort of non-LRU patterns. So an example of this was access once or scan. So these were patterns that LRU did poorly for. And we mentioned that, well, you can do some heuristics to avoid that. And we gave the example of Linux's clock pro policy. Pro require 2x references to avoid keeping data from files that is used once only. So they had this policy where they worked to detect if something was likely just being scanned over once, because they realized that LRU approximations were not what you wanted for that. Explicitly didn't want to do LRU. Then we talked about some things we can do beyond just making different decisions when we decide what page to replace, and that we don't have to have our cache, our page cache, act only when we have a miss. So one thing we could do for writes is that we could track whether pages were modified and needed to be written back to disk, but we could do that in advance. In particular for files, where we know we eventually want it written back anyways. So we could do that, and that had the advantage of meaning that we wouldn't lose data when we run out of power, even though we were caching everything. We have this idea of read ahead, that if we have this scanning pattern, then it's really useful to read what the program is about to access, because that avoids cache misses that previously we would say were inevitable. And that's actually fairly easy to do. We just look for periodic accesses and read values in advance. And we also talked about evicting things in advance, that when we're replacing pages, there's a bunch of work we have to do in order to remove a page from all the page tables and all the other data structures it's in. And we really want those cache misses to go as fast as possible. In particular, we really don't want to delay like starting a read from the disk, which is already slow enough. So one thing we can do for that is we can evict pages in advance, maybe even like clear them so they're all zeroed out in advance, rather than waiting until the program needs it. And if we only do this for a small number of pages, this will still make things a lot faster, And it doesn't have a big cost in terms of evicting things we care about from our memory. So after that, we started talking about devices. And we mentioned that, a reminder, that we had this buffering in the kernel, that we had this read-write interface for talking to devices where you'd write and it would go to a buffer in the kernel and go to the device when the device was actually ready for the data. And when you read, it would read from a buffer in the kernel and wait until that buffer had enough stuff in it, and that buffer would be filled as the device produced data. And we did this to deal with this disconnect between exactly what you were reading and writing and what the devices were capable of. So any questions about things we covered last time? So when we finished up last time, I mentioned we have in the POSIX design these device files. So every device is represented by a file. And like if we want to output audio, we can open up this DevSound PCM device and write to it data that represents the audio. And that will somehow end up going out our speakers or our headphone jack. And the similar is true for like our mouse. We can open up this file and read from it and get indications of how the mouse is moving. So these are going to all implement our interfaces we've seen before. So like read, write, and mmap. But there are operations there that just aren't enough. Like for the audio, like we want one to say, what's the format of the audio? Maybe there's multiple ones we could choose from. If you know about audio, you know there's a sample rate. What sample rate do we use? You might be able to configure that. And that doesn't obviously map to a read or write operation. If we're thinking about the terminal, there's a setting for whether the terminal should echo back what you're saying or not, echo back what you type or not, or just let, and that's a thing that you want to configure. You like have a CD, you can sometimes have the device eject the drive. That's something that, you know, sort of isn't a normal read-write operation. So POSIX provides some extra operations, which are just basically let the device choose what happens. And also, you'll sometimes see that rather than having one device file, we'll have a whole set of them. For example, Linux for sound typically does this. There's these extra devices which are, you know, audio devices, but they don't like represent the speaker or the headphones. They represent the thing which controls how the audio is being sent out as a separate file. But whatever interface we implement, that there's going to be some part of our kernel which implements that and needs to talk to the rest. And because we have a whole lot of these, we're going to have, you know, some set of operations each of these device drivers implements to handle how that file works. So in Linux, for example, there's a struct of function pointers that every device driver provides. You aren't like way up on function pointer syntax in C, and I understand you probably wouldn't be because it's not used very often and very ugly. These are all function pointers. And you can see we have a read operation, a write operation, an mmap operation, an open operation, and so on. And these take not the arguments that come directly from the system call, but we've like done the lookup of the file descriptor and all that by the time we send it to the device driver. But basically, the device driver ends up deciding what that read system call does for this device file. And it can choose whatever makes sense based on the type of device it's working with. So this is the interface for what are sometimes known as character devices. So these are devices where we read and write bytes. But we're going to have a special case in most POSIX-like OSs, including Linux, usually have a separate category of devices we call block devices. And these are things which work with the page cache. So when we read something from disk, we want it to be part of the page cache. So the interface that we want to have with the device driver is not the one where we read and write, like bytes, like our system calls, but the one where we ask to bring stuff into the page cache or write stuff out from the page cache. So in Linux, there's a completely separate set of operations you implement if you're a block device, if you're something like a disk, and that looks like this. And the idea is that if you're doing read and write to a disk, a file representing a disk, it's going to use the page cache, and the page cache is going to handle the read and write system calls using these operations when it needs to load something in or write something back out. And you can see here the big operation we have is, given our device, write a page, a physical page out to the device, or read a physical page. Okay, so those are our device operations. So what does the device driver do? So it's going to get this I/O request, either like a read or write, or that read or write page operation from the rest of the kernel. So this could just be the system call handler looks up what the device, this driver this refers to, calls it. This could go through the page cache and like the page fault handler, but somehow the device driver gets a request to do an I/O operation. And the first thing it's going to do is going to check whether it actually needs to talk to the device at all, because it's possible that it already has the data in its buffer. So like if it's the keyboard device, it's going to have a buffer of key presses it hasn't sent out yet. If it has enough in there, it's just going to send those out and say, I'm done, and return. Otherwise, it's going to have to like start the I/O operation. So if this is something like a disk, we'll need to communicate with the device. If it's something like a keyboard, well, the keyboard's always sending data to us, so we don't do anything. We just put the thread asleep. But we do anything needed to tell the device to start our operation, and then we put the current thread that made the request to sleep and run something else. Then eventually, the device is going to finish that operation, and we'll get an interrupt. And from the interrupt handler, we're going to update our buffer and wake up the sleeping thread, and if we need to, if it's ready to run. If it's not ready to run, maybe we have to make another request to the device. Like, let's say you asked to read a lot from the disk, and we read the first half of it, then we won't wake you up, we'll just do the second half now, and wake you up after that's done. So this is the model, assuming that, you know, notice that we're doing our I/O in a way where we wait while the I/O is happening. And this is what we saw with thread scheduling, that we run something else while the I/O is happening. And we're hoping our device supports this by giving us this interrupt when the I/O finishes. If it didn't do that, then we'd have to do something a lot less efficient. So we have these two halves of the device driver. So the part which handles the I/O request is commonly called the top half. There's also other names. But this is one routine in the device driver. And there's a second routine, which I'll call the bottom half, which is called from the trap handler. So there are two parts of the device driver. One part is called from system calls and sometimes other things. And the other part is called from interrupts corresponding to its particular device. And the device driver maker writes both of these parts. And the usual pattern, this is obviously not the only choice you have, is that the trap handler just updates the buffers and marks threads as runnable, but doesn't actually handle like returning the result of the operation. And the other half, the top half, actually handles all the stuff about what type of read or write is this, and so on, and how do I return the result separately. So to give some concrete examples of this, I'm going to go through what XV6 does for the keyboard device. But first, so questions on this general flow chart. So in XV6, we have device drivers implement a table of operations, which is much simpler than Linux's. They implement read and write for devices like the console. And they take this inode. Inode represents a file on disk. And we're going to make a file that represents the device, and that's just going to have some flag in it saying, this is not a normal file on disk, this represents a device. So when you use this file, look up a device in this list of all our devices. So this is an array of just all the possible devices, and we look up based on some number we store alongside the file. So this is how we can have a name for the device. We just, the name, the file, the disk, we just store this name, console, is device number one. So there's a special type of file. There's, in fact, a system call to make it called makenode. In XV6, the file just contains this one number. Unix and Linux actually do something similar, except they have a pair of numbers. But there's just a pair of numbers which tell you what device driver does this file refer to. This is sort of the bridge between I need to store something on disk, but I can't store a pointer to the device driver because that might change when I reboot my system. So at boot, XV6 sets up this with the information representing the console. So there's a read and a write routine. So the read routine handles reading from the keyboard. The write routine handles writing out to the display. And console is just the constant number one, because that's the array index they chose for this device. It's the number that identifies it. So let's look at the part after we got the I/O request, and when we've dispatched to, we'll start with the read function. We'll just do the keyboard part. So when we dispatch to the read function, we're going to first check if we can satisfy this from our buffer. And if not, we're going to put it to sleep. So here's an excerpt from the code that's executed for a read. So in this case, we acquire a lock because there might be multiple threads that try to read from the console at once. And we check whether we're at the end of the buffer. So they keep track of a reading location and a writing location. So they're just saying, is the next place we're writing where we're trying to read from? If so, we're out of, you know, there's nothing to read. We're waiting for it to be written. And while that's true, we put the current thread to sleep. And we pass this input R value. And the purpose of this is going to be used to find thread to wake it up. So this is like kind of similar to a condition variable, to put waiting on a condition variable. And you can think of this as kind of similar to doing a condition wait, because we also have a lock we're unlocked while waiting. So this is basic, very similar to a condition wait, including even the while loop around it. So this is our waiting for that. And you might say, what about the sending or queuing the I/O operation? So we have a special case here that when we have a keyboard connected to our machine, it's going to give us input without us requesting it. So we don't need to do anything special to tell the keyboard to give us input. So there's no code to do that. It's going to happen, regardless of whether we request it. But if this was something like a disk or like the display, then we're going to have to actually do something proactive to start sending the data to it. So then we have a part where after we're finished waiting, we're going to store and return the result. And there, we retrieve a copy of the write part of the buffer. So we get the character from the buffer here. Notice that we're using our read index and copy to the pointer passed to read. And we have, and we do this up to the amount the user requests of the read or a new line. That's just a choice that they made when designing this. They could have made some other choices too. And they return how much was actually read. Yes?
What is
n in this case? This is the size passed to read. Other questions? So our basic idea is we wait for the buffer to have data, and when it does, we copy from it, and we repeat this process until we're done, until we've read enough characters, or a new line is the choice they've made. You can make other choices, like you could say, I'm going to return when I've read any characters. That'd also be fine, but they decide if they're going to wait until a new line or the number requested. So this is the top half, and notice that, you know, this doesn't actually deal with getting the data from the device, because for the keyboard, that's triggered when the keyboard tells us it has data. We don't get that proactively in this case, so we have an interrupt from the keyboard. So there's a case in the trap function, which deals with the keyboard interrupt, and that's this trap number. So this TIRQ plus keyboard, so IRQ stands for something like interrupt request. And the number of the interrupt request for the keyboard. So when we get that, we call this keyboard interrupt routine, and I'll show you what that is in a bit. There's also the second part, this LAPCIEOI, and this is a function which tells the CPU, I'm done handling this interrupt. If you don't call that, the CPU will give you the interrupt again, assuming you still need to handle it. So we have this keyboard interrupt routine, and this is what handles updating buffers and waking up that thread if it was needed. So it actually reads to the buffer. It does, it adds the data to the buffer, and it also wakes up the sleeping thread, so it does the equivalent of con broadcast to wake up someone saying, hey, the buffer's bigger now, and you might have enough data for you to read. So the question is, how do we actually read from the device? Well, the question then, you have to know, how is the device connected to our machine? So I'm going to show you a common way for devices to be connected, and that's going to be that we're going to take advantage of this memory bus. So you remember we talked about like multiple processors being connected to one memory bus? We're going to connect what we'll call device controllers. And this is basically a little piece of hardware that sits between our processor and the device. It could be on a separate from the processor, it could be part of the processor, but it's something that, like a processor core, is connected to the memory bus. And it's going to implement the interface of the memory bus. And on the memory bus, we have reads and writes. And our device controller is going to have what we're going to call control registers. And this is going to tell us what's going on with the device. And this is how we're going to figure out, you know, is the device ready to give me data, and so on. And how you're going to tell the device start reading, you're going to set the control register to say read now. It also is going to have buffers and queues. So when we want to
read data from the device, it's going to have its own buffer of, here's the data that I just got. You can copy to your own memory. So the question is, how do we access this then? We know it's on the, this thing is connected to the memory bus. How do we get at these control registers to figure out if the device is ready? How do we get at the buffer? And the answer is, we're going to assign a memory address to each of these things. So each of these control registers, we're just going to make up a physical memory address and assign it to that. And the device controller is going to look for people trying to read or write that address, and it's going to say, I'm the memory for that address. Even though it's not really memory, it's something else. But it's going to do the same thing memory would do as far as getting a read, getting a write, and deal with that address. And we'll also have addresses for our buffers and queues here, so that's how we'll access those. It will handle, if you try to read from the buffer, it will figure out what's in that buffer, give it to you. And because it's handling the request to read or write directly from the memory bus, it can have control registers which don't act like registers you're used to. Like you're used to, a register stores a value and that's all. It can make it so when you write to the write register, it ignores the value you were writing, but it just interprets that as a command to start writing. And that's something it can do because it just sees write to this value. It can interpret that however it wants. So you give commands by doing a store, but that doesn't mean the store actually changes a value. It could just trigger an operation. And there we said, buffers and queues have memory addresses. So there's another thing we need besides what the memory bus provides, and that's we need some way of triggering interrupts. So we're going to have some at least conceptually separate connection. It might be part of the memory bus where we can tell the processor, hey, I'm the keyboard controller and I want to do an interrupt right now. And this is how the processor knows to trigger an exception in that case. And we have in the processor an interrupt controller, and the interrupt controller handles things like, what if I want to disable interrupts while I'm handling one? It's going to handle that. What do I do if three devices have interrupts at the same time? Which ones do I do? It's going to make all those choices. Okay. So this is sort of a basic way things are connected, and as an extension to this, a very common thing is we'll have what I'll call bus adapters, because your devices aren't connected often directly to the memory bus, but to another bus that is connected to the memory bus. So we'll have some piece of hardware that goes in between the memory bus and that and handles that this connection works with a different protocol, and we'll do the translation. Questions on this high-level idea of connecting up devices? So what we get from this overall is that our devices are kind of this magic memory, that they just expose memory locations we read or write to, and those read or write instructions, rather than just changing values, actually manipulate the actual device. So for example, with our keyboard controller, we read from a memory location, and maybe it gets the last key press and release. And it could be the case, because this device controller decides what read does, that it also clears that and frees it up for the next key press or release. That's a very common thing to do, is just why have a separate operation to clear it? Just when you read it, we'll give you the value and clear it and be ready for the next value. And the interrupt will happen if there's a key press you haven't read. And it even tracks whether you've read them. It's kind of, you know, magic like that. It's not like normal memory. It can do more intelligent things. Okay. And we might have similar for like a display controller. Maybe the display controller gives us a special memory location where if we write values representing pixels to it, it just shows up on the screen. And it handles all of the work to do that translation. And maybe there's some other memory locations which handle like what's the format of the screen and so on.
Yes.
So like mesh memory locations copy to and from the registers, or are they just aliases to the registers?
So the question is, are these copy to or from the control registers? There's some logic which decides how to manipulate. So I guess I should say the control registers I'm talking about are conceptual ideas of what the memory locations are. The actual implementation in the device controller is very flexible. So they could actually be registers, or they could be something else. But we call what we expose through these memory locations registers typically by convention, because often they are physical registers that are mapped to this memory address. But they might not really be physical registers. Yes?
So what are these addresses created? Is it when we add it to the struct?
So the question is, how are these addresses created? So I don't know the details of how this happens in practice. In modern systems. So the simplest way, and what many older things do, is that you just have fixed addresses for some things. And for some devices, this is very common. Like keyboards, there are some old keyboard interfaces where it's at this address, it's always there. This is, in fact, what XV6 uses, one of those. And for some more modern devices, where we have to deal, like, what if I plug in something into my, computer and it changes, there's going to be like a device controller that configures other device controllers and sets up these addresses. But the simplest scheme is you just choose a fixed address and say, that's the address. And that is used for at least some of the devices. So we have, as I said, the display controller. And we might have other memory locations that control the format and size, and those would be our control registers. We might have a network interface where we write to buffers, and then we write a send signal to a location, and that takes the data in the buffers and writes it to our network device. And then we have a status location we read from to find out, is there data for us to read? And when there is, we copy from the buffer and update the status. So this is a very nice way of letting us talk to devices without adding anything to our processor. But there's a slight issue, which is caches. So let's say I have my keyboard controller where I say I can, read from memory location and get the last key press and release. So I press H, the OS reads from that location and gets the H. Does that get cached? Well, it's a memory location, I'm loading from it, we would think it would get cached. But then I press E, the OS reads from that memory location, and it reads H. So that would be a problem. So we somehow need to prevent that. And the solution that is typically used for this is that the OS can explicitly tell the processor, do not cache this part of memory. So in XV6, one way of doing this is that there's a bit in page table entries to say, when you're using this page table entry to access some memory, don't do caching. And XV6 enables this for all the parts of memory that correspond to device controllers. So there's something kind of historic that XE6 and XV6 does for the keyboard controller in particular, which makes this not apply. So in XE6, I talked about everything using the memory bus, and that's the more modern, more elegant solution. XE6 is not modern or elegant, so they used memory addresses for some things. So there's some devices XV6 uses which use memory addresses, but they also have a separate set of addresses called I/O addresses, which are like memory addresses, but there's a different bus historically and a different instruction to access them. So there's these in and out instructions which work like load and store, except they're accessing a set, a different bus than the memory bus. But more recent processors And more recent devices on even processors which still have these I/O addresses tend to use the memory bus instead. Note especially that like having the separate bus isn't actually that helpful because you can use this sort of this bus adapter pattern here to handle if the device controller doesn't actually understand how to talk to your memory bus. But the XV6 code, if you look at it, it uses the separate I/O addresses. But it's the same as reading and writing from memory, just that for historical reasons, they have it separated from memory addresses. So for the keyboard that XV6 uses, there are two control registers. Well, it's a control register and a buffer. And these are just at fixed addresses. So that's how they chose the addresses. They're I/O addresses, not memory addresses, but it would work the same if they chose a memory address for them instead. And the XV6 code has this function which just is a wrapper for the I/O address load instruction in B for in 1 byte. So this is what's run from the trap handler for a keyboard key press. It first reads the status from the keyboard controller. And there's one bit in that status register which says, is there data in the buffer? And if there is, it reads the data, which clears the buffer, and it gets one key press. And then after it reads that data, then there's some code to figure out what does that data mean, because it turns out the keyboard controller doesn't just put H if you press H, it does something else. Yes?
So could XV6 work with multiple keyboards installed?
Question is, could XV6 work with multiple keyboards installed? So this keyboard interface, which is rather historical, assumes there's only one keyboard. So you need some other type of interface to reason about multiple keyboards in the same way. And, you know. Notably, XV6 doesn't support USB. So, yeah, that's why you're missing a lot of things there. Okay. So, other questions? Okay, so this way of talking to your devices I talked about is sometimes known as programmed I/O. And what I mean by that, you know, the distinction is that the operating system is reading or writing from the device controller directly. And when we're transferring data, we need to transfer a lot of data. We run some loop to transfer data to and from the device controller. So the OS is responsible for actually moving the data to where it wants. This is triggered by an interrupt sometimes. It might not always be. So like if we're writing to our display, you know, if we can write right away, we might just do that. We won't wait for an interrupt. There's an alternate design, which is particularly important when we're talking about devices like disks, where we're not reading or writing, like here, we're reading or writing 1 byte. But with a disk, we're typically reading or writing like megabytes. And this copy to and from the buffer gets expensive. And there's this neat trick we can do because we've decided to connect all our devices to our memory bus. And that's, well, the devices are in just as good a position to access memory as the processor is. So the devices could just read and write memory instead of the processor getting the data from the device and then sending it to memory, which is what we were doing before. So rather than having the data go device controller through the memory bus to the processor and then from the processor to the actual memory, we could just have the processor send it to the device controller send it to the actual memory. And this is known as direct memory access. So if you have something like a disk controller or a network controller, this can be very useful because there's a lot of data to move. And the device controller can do the copying while the OS is working on other things. So the way this works is we'll remove the buffers from the device controller and add a new control register, which is the address to use for the buffers. And the OS will say, OK, I'm going to choose an address. So it will write a physical address. Why a physical address? Well, because our page tables, you know, our page table translation happens here. And there's not any page table translation between the device controller and the actual memory. So we'll write a physical address to that. And the device controller will use that to access the actual memory instead of keeping a buffer internally. So when this device controller gets some data, it can write it to that actual memory address, or if it needed to read data and send it to the device, it can read it from that memory address. And later on, the OS reads from that memory address rather than copying from the device controller's buffer. And this avoids having us actually wait to do this loop, you know, while the device is reading. Instead, we just start the I/O operation, and we come back later, and it's already in a useful place, and the device controller can move on to the next I/O operation. Notably, like, we don't have to worry about running out of buffer space. If we want to use more buffer space, we just give it a different physical address. So we aren't constrained by how big is the buffer on the device controller. We can make it as big as we want. So, and the best case is maybe we could put the actual data where we wanted it in the first place. We were going to copy it anyways. That would be the best case. So direct memory access is usually much faster than having the processor run a loop to copy data, partly because, you know, the device controller is doing that loop for us, so like it's like we have an extra core for that copy. And, you know, and we just wait until an interrupt happens to figure out that it's done. So we'll just have an interrupt saying, copy's done, and that's all the work we need to do. We aren't spending CPU cycles doing this non-computation copying. And it also gives the device a very large buffer space, whereas typically a device controller wouldn't have a giant amount of memory. It would be unusual to put like a gigabyte of memory on your network controller, but using a gigabyte of memory for buffers for your network device on your web server is something that would be very common to do. And maybe, if we're really lucky, we can put the data directly where we want it. And it seems like, you know, I call read from the disk, it should be the case that, you know, or I call mmap, it should be the case I get loaded directly into my page cache. And sometimes this works out. It's actually, you know, a little tricky, though, because with the model I showed you before, the device driver has a buffer, and that's not where it actually ends up. And it turns out that it's a lot less frequent than you would think that we actually get the data directly where the application that requested to read it wants it. And probably our best case for doing that is if you have an mmap file and it's the page cache, but even then, it's sometimes hard. This idea is called zero copy I/O. Zero copy because conceptually, the device controller can write it as it gets it from the device, and there's no extra copies. And it's a really nice idea and happens extremely rarely in practice. So it maybe happens for disk data, which goes directly into the page cache. For stuff you're reading from the network, it's extremely rare to see actually happen. And if we're thinking of something like the page cache, well, we have lots of issues. Something like a network controller, we have lots of issues which come up and make this hard. So one issue with our network controller is that it's possible our network controller expects to write more than a page. and it expects to write it to contiguous physical addresses. This means that we need to somehow make sure that we allocate multiple physical addresses for where we're putting the data that are next to each other, which kind of makes things a lot less convenient. It might expect to start at the beginning of a physical page, but maybe the web server called read with an address that wasn't at the beginning of a physical page. Well, then, too bad. It might get the data in a different format. On our network, we have these network packets, which have a whole bunch of extra data you'll learn about when you take if you take networking. And we need to do some processing to get the actual data the web server wants. And because of that, we can't just have it be sent directly. We need to copy it to get it in the format the application expects. We also have issues like we get some data from the device. It might be data that's not for the web server. It might be data for my SSH session. And we have to like figure that out. And we also have the issue that, let's say, I set up the device to copy directly to my web server's memory, and then my web server shuts down. I need to make sure that the device copying there doesn't cause a problem. So all this extra work means that even though this is definitely possible and definitely a good idea, it's actually surprisingly rare to see it done, especially for things other than disk. For disk, we can maybe go directly to the page cache because we know that we're keeping that in memory. But for things like the network card, which is often where you care about this more, because you can't cache your requests that are coming in right now from the network in memory, you know, this is actually rarely done because you have to deal with all these difficulties. You can do it, it's just hard. And probably involves changing the API the web server uses, which is the biggest thing. Okay, so that's about devices. So let's, as an interlude, have a little exercise working through what happens with devices. So let's say we have an application that reads from the network, and it calls read to get 8 kilobytes of data from the network. Then 16 kilobytes comes in after 10 milliseconds. Then it calls read again to get remaining 4 kilobytes it cares about. And there's still 4 kilobytes left. Get, and still 4k left at end. So in this process, how many mode switches do we have, and how many context switches do we have? Someone have an answer they can share? Anyone want more time? Good. So I have a diagram for this, which is one way to go through it. So we're running A. A makes its read call, and then enters the top half of our device driver. And remember that what that should do is it should start the request to read and find out, well, there's no data, so we're going to put A to sleep, waiting for an interrupt from our network controller to say, there's data now. And while that happens, we're presumably going to run B because it wants to run, and we're not going to leave the CPU idle, and we don't want to just like keep checking, hey, network device, do you have more data? Because it's going to give us an interrupt instead. So then after we get an interrupt from the device, we switch to kernel mode again to handle the bottom half of the device driver, which handles processing that interrupt, and that's going to copy from the device into the OS's buffer, or if the network controller used direct memory access, it's going to process the data that it deposited in the device driver's buffer. And then it's going to mark A as ready to go. So then there's a question of when do we run A? And you would say, okay, maybe we should run A right away. And that's a good idea, but that depends on their scheduling policy. So maybe we keep running B, maybe we run A right away, but we run something, and eventually we decide to switch to A from the kernel mode, and we return from that read system call after doing the part of copying from the device driver's buffer into A's memory, where it requested the data. Then A runs for a bit. Maybe B run, switch, we switch to B in the middle of here, maybe not. And then we read the rest. And this doesn't need us to do anything special with the device because the data is already in the buffer. So we just run the top half of the device driver, it copies from that buffer, and it's done. There's no need to communicate with the device to handle that second read. So if we count mode switches, we get, at least 6 and potentially 2 extra, potentially more extra if we think that we're switching to B more often. So, like, if we think that B gets to run in between here, we might switch another time. And if we're thinking of context switches, we have at least 2, and potentially more if B gets to run more often because of our scheduling policy. So, questions about this? Yeah. What part of A runs in user mode? The part that's making all the system calls and handling the results of all the system calls, presumably. Yes. Other questions? Okay, so that's on devices. So one thing I mentioned earlier when I talked about doing doing this idea of let's write the data right where the application wants it, like let's handle that read from the network controller by just putting it into the application's read buffer. One issue I mentioned is that devices sort of expect these physical addresses. That's just how they work. And this is actually kind of inconvenient. So there's a hardware solution here. So typically we need contiguous physical addresses. So that's inconvenient because if I want to have a megabyte buffer for my network interface card, I need to give it a megabyte of memory that's not separate pages, which means I need to have a way of allocating multiple pages together, even though I don't need that for anything else. That seems inconvenient. And there's another issue, which is perhaps more insidious, which is that if a device messes up, it can overwrite whatever it wants. It's on the memory bus, it can do anything. So if your device is buggy in some way, all of a sudden everything's broken. Like it just overwrote the kernel, too bad. So a Harvard feature which is surprisingly recent is something known as an I/O memory management unit. And this is basically page tables for the device controllers. So something in between the device controller and the memory bus that does address translation. so you can enforce protection. And you would think that maybe the reason we do this is like because of this problem, but actually the main reason that these have become widely implemented is because they help virtual machines. In particular, if you want your virtual machine to talk directly to a device, if it's going to set an address in its control registers to write to, that's a problem because your virtual machine, if it messes up, could set an address that is not part of the virtual machine. So that's why these have become popular, is that this is a way of preventing that from happening and still having the virtual machine talk to the device more directly. So that's what I have to say about devices. So we have these device controllers connected via the memory bus, possibly not directly. And the controller sort of exposes things which look like memory locations, but they can be more magical than memory locations. So they can, edit these control registers, and when you do reads and writes, that could actually trigger operations because the device controller is deciding how those reads or writes are handled. And we talked about these two ways we can do data transfer. We can do data transfer with programmed I/O, where the OS reads or writes to the buffer within the device controller, or with this direct memory access where we say, hey device, you're on the memory bus, you write to this buffer yourself. And we mentioned programmed I/O is perfectly fine for something like a keyboard where, well, we need to get the status anyway, so why bother having the device do the copying of the 1 byte of data that when we already need to check how much data is there, or are we finished, and versus like something like disk where we want direct memory access because there's so much data being transferred, and with direct memory access, we can probably have the device controller put it something closer to where we want it anyways. So questions about devices? Yes?
How do you deal with caches if we're doing direct memory access?
So what?
How do you deal with caches?
How do we deal with caches if we do direct memory access? So there are options. So one option is that you could hope that there's an instruction to invalidate a part of the cache. And that's probably the simplest thing to do. The other, I think that's usually what's done. I'm not sure. Oh, no, sorry, with direct memory access, how do you deal with caches? So I'm not sure. So one option is the OS invalidates the cache. Another option is that the device controllers use the cache invalidation protocol to invalidate the cache the same way another processor writing to the memory would. I'm not actually sure which is common. But those are both ways that could be handled. Yeah?
On the previous slide, when it says device needs contiguous physical addresses, that's just only for one device, right? It's not multiple devices.
So not multiple devices. And I guess I should put a caveat. Often, like, the device controller could, and some do, support an interface where you, like, have multiple buffer addresses. But, like, usually if, like, they want to store 16K, they're going to put it all in contiguous addresses. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's on devices. So our next topic is going to be about file systems. So this is from the level above devices, we know we have something which communicates with a disk. How do we actually make the disk contain useful data? So to talk about that, I'm going to need to start by talking about how do we communicate with disks. So hard drives and solid state drives are divided into what we'll call sectors. So sectors, historically, were 512 bytes. On recent disks, they're sometimes larger. And the commands that the disk controller takes are basically read a range of sectors or write a range of sectors. And we'll talk about disk performance probably next time, but it's better to read or write more than one sector at a time. But one sector is the minimum you can do. If you want to read 10 bytes, sorry, you can't do that. You're doing at least 512. You don't have a choice. You want to write 10 bytes, changing what's there? Well, then you better read 512 bytes, change 10 bytes of it, and write 512 bytes back. And I'm mentioning this because this is going to influence how our file systems are designed. We're going to make sure that we take advantage of reading whole sectors at once. So a file system, we want to store sort of a hierarchy of data. So like we have some tree, this example from 2150 slides, of files and directories, some tree of directories, files. And our disk is just a flat list of sectors. So we somehow, in that flat list, need to represent this tree. And there's a whole lot of choices we could use to do that. So I'm going to start talking about one very simple set of choices, and we'll go into some other options after we talk about what's fast with hard drives and solid-state disks and what isn't. But there are a bunch of problems we need to solve. So if we identify a file, how do we find its data? It's going to be somewhere in that flat list. What locations? So we need some place to store it, identify what sectors contain the file. If we have a directory, we need some way of knowing what files are in it. We also have this metadata about files and directories. If you log into one of the department machines, there's an owner of files, and you own files, and someone else doesn't. We need to store that information on disk somewhere and decide the format and where it is. We also need to figure out what we're going to do to grow this structure. If we're making a new file, we need to choose a location on this disk to put it. So we need some way to make that choice. If we're making a file or directory bigger than it already is, we need to figure out where does the extra data go. So all of our file systems are going to come up with different sets of answers to these questions. So we're going to look at the FAT file system to start out because it's really simple. It's not a particularly good design, but it's a really simple design. Also, we have a homework where you're going to implement reading from a FAT file system. We're not going to have you read from a disk directly. We're going to have you read from a file, just to keep things simple. But the same code you wrote to read from the file should work for reading from a disk, because the disk is represented by a device file, which has the same interface as the file. So the FAT file system, FAT stands for File Allocation Table. And it's named after its most important data structure, which is called the file allocation table. So we're going to talk about that later. But first, I'm going to talk about how the FAT file system divides up our disk. So I mentioned our disk was divided into sectors. And FAT divides the disk into clusters. And clusters are not sectors. So each cluster is composed of one or more sectors. So we might, for example, have this cluster 24 here is the 24th from the beginning of the disk. The disk just, we have sector number 0 through the end. We'll talk about how that maps to physically later. And that sector has multiple, that cluster has multiple sectors that make it up. So the reason for doing this is, well, the sector is determined by what the hardware does. The hardware decides I have 512-byte sectors or 1,024-byte sectors. But we might prefer to work in bigger units for our file system. We're not going to work in smaller units because the hardware is going to make that really inconvenient. But working in bigger units is very convenient because our read and write commands, we just specify a range that includes all the sectors in the cluster. So this is what FAT has chosen to do, is it chooses this cluster size, and when you create a FAT file system, when you, what we call format a disk, you choose, in FAT, the size of the clusters. And this is the unit that FAT's going to reference the disk in, even though it has to translate this to sectors when it actually uses the disk. And that is going to store files data as a list of clusters. So we're going to choose some clusters to contain a file. So like we might say example.txt is in clusters 10, 13, 14, and 15. And that's how we're going to store files data. So you might say, what if the file size is in a multiple of the cluster size, like all the time? Well, we're just going to waste space. We're just going to use the space that we need, and the rest going to be wasted, too bad. And to read a file, we're just going to find a list of clusters and get the data. So we need to somewhere store this list of clusters, and this is what the file allocation table is going to store. So the file allocation table is an array on disk with one entry in the array per cluster. And each entry contains a number, and that number indicates a next cluster. So when we're reading a file, we're going to use this file allocation table as a sort of linked list. So for example, if I have a file at starting at cluster 10, then this tells me that I know the cluster after cluster 10 for the file is cluster 14, the cluster after 14 is 15, the cluster after 15 is 13, and that's the end of the file because of the special index negative 1. And to figure this out, I just need to read this big array and look at the indices corresponding to the cluster numbers. Now, there's some question here about where do I get this 10, this where we started? We'll get to that later. But once we have that, this is how FAT just figures out what's the all the places where the file data is stored. Now, I said we had this big array on disk, so the question of where do we put that? And the choice in FAT is that they put it near the beginning of the disk. We're going to put this big array. We're just going to store it however many clusters it takes up that many clusters. We're just store it there. We want to read it. We just read the sector containing the part of the array we care about. Or more commonly, maybe we load this array into memory to avoid keeping reading from the disk. And in this array, we can have all our files represented. So here I have a file that starts at index 7 and contains three blocks that are stored right next to each other. I have a file, the file I showed you before, that starts at index 10 and contains this linked list of blocks represented by this array. So it's just a linked list, except instead of pointers, we have cluster numbers, which are effectively our pointers for things on disk. So our reading process is just iterate through that array until we're done. But the problem is we need the start location. So where are we getting the start location? Well, we're using a file name to get it. And we need to look up the file name and what it corresponds to. And this information is stored in directories. So our directories are going to actually be files. But they're going to be files where instead of the data being like bytes we'd read from the file with the read system call, they're going to be just a list of name, starting location, and other metadata we care about. So on disk, we'll have a directory containing a file. And for example, this directory might say there's a file called index.html. It starts at cluster 10, and we'll have some extra data, like that file is 12,792 bytes long. So why are we storing how long the file is in the directory? When we already have this end marker. So remember that back here, when I was looking at this, I knew how long the file was because I have this null in my linked list. So why would I be storing the size of the file in the directory? Yeah. So you're saying in case the memory is corrupted, that's one. So it does provide redundancy. So I can possibly recover more data if the fat is not intact. Yeah?
Oh, in case you, I guess, accidentally skip one of them.
In case we skip one of them? Any other ideas? There's a more important reason why. Yeah?
Your n cluster tells you how big the file is in clusters, but you may not use the entirety of the last cluster.
Yeah, so remember I said if the file wasn't a multiple of cluster sizes, we don't use all the space. So we need to know how much do I actually give the program that's trying to read from the file. So we need it in order to make the files be a certain number of bytes long, even if that's not a multiple of the cluster size. Okay, so we'll store the directory as a file, so it will have a list of its clusters in the FAT, and that will contain our information about what's there. And we'll read this to figure out where, say, index.html is. Then we'll figure out, okay, these are the clusters corresponding to index.html. And we'll even learn that from this size, we'll know that, oh, the last part of that last cluster is not all used. And we'll know how to give the application the data for the file. Questions about this? Yes.
What keeps track of like unused clusters?
So what keeps track of unused clusters? We will get to that later. That is important. The answer is going to turn out to be the file allocation table. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So this basically uses if you only use like half the cluster. Is that what you're saying? Like if you don't.
So the question, if the size is not a multiple, we end up only using like half of a cluster or something? Yes. We could potentially like only use 1 byte of a cluster even. Yes.
Is the array at the beginning that keeps track of everything, is that always the same size?
Question, is the array at the beginning always the same size? So that file allocation table needs to have an entry for every cluster. So its size is going to depend on how many clusters the disk has. Other questions? So you might say, OK, you have this data listed. How do you store that? So FAT has made a very particular choice for how each of these, what I'll call directory entries, are stored. And they represent that with this format. So they just say directory entries are this 32-byte structure. I believe that's 32 bytes, where we have a file name and extension, which are encoded in maybe not the way you expected. Then some attributes. So this is metadata. So what are examples of metadata that they want about it? Is it a directory or a normal file? Like that's important to know. Then they have time. So when was this file created? When was it last accessed? And when was it last written to? And they also have the size. So here the size is in little endian. And they have a 4-byte field for that. If you want a file that's bigger than 32 bytes in this version of FAT, too bad. So bigger than that, 2 to the 32 bytes, too bad. And they also have the cluster number. For historical reasons, the cluster number is split into two parts. The historical reason is that it used to be a 16-bit cluster number. Then they realized that disks aren't small anymore. So we have this file name. So you might say, what about longer file names? So this stores 8 characters plus a 3-character extension. This is because this is what DOS did. That's what they chose. you might say, we have longer file names. So FAT does support longer file names, but they use additional directory entries to encode them because of history, that they didn't think of supporting long file names until later, so they kind of added it on later. For the assignment, we're only going to have you care about these short file names to keep things simple, because dealing with how long file names are encoded isn't interesting. And those attributes I mentioned. And we also have to deal with how do we know how big the directory is, and what do we do about deleting files? So they have this convention that 0 for the first character of the file name means this is the last entry in the directory, you can stop reading now. And the value E5 is what they put in when they delete a file. So rather than rewriting the whole directory to remove a file, they just change that one directory entry so the file name starts with E5 to indicate it's not a real file anymore. Okay, and we'll talk more about how FAT works next time.